Shrink Wrap Radio number 737. Psychoanalyst Corinne Mazur on Winnicott's most famous child therapy case.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today, Corinne Mazur, PsyD, is a child and adult psychoanalyst who has been in practice for over 35 years, treating children, adolescents, and adults. We'll be discussing the book she edited, Finding the Piggle, Reconsidering D.W. Winnicott's Most Famous Child Case. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Corinne Mazur, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much, David. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm really glad to have you here, and I'm really excited to talk to you about your book, which is kind of a very interesting, off-the-beaten-track book in a way, and it's got a very interesting title, too. It's called Finding the Piggle, D.W. Winnicott's Most Famous Child Case. So let me ask you, how did you come to be involved in this project?
Well, that's kind of a long story, actually, David. I read The Piggle, which is just a classic case history, when I was in graduate school. And I was very interested in psychology. I was in a clinical psychology graduate training program, but I wanted to be a child psychologist. And eventually, I wanted to be a child analyst. Uh-huh. And anyone who's interested in children, child analysis, child therapy, either has read The Piggle or should read The Piggle. It's just a classic, classic case. And then I left The Piggle somewhere in the dark reaches of my memory banks as I went through graduate school, went on to analytic training, became an analyst, became a child analyst. You know, The Piggle was always there in the back of my mind. And then one day I saw a paper being advertised that was going to be presented in Philadelphia by someone I knew, Deborah Lubnitz, who's a wonderful, wonderful analyst in Philadelphia. And it was called Finding the Piggle. And I thought, what could this be about? I have to go to hear this. And this was about Deborah Lubnitz, who is a wonderful analyst and has an interesting organization that she started called IPA, Insight for All. She works with the homeless population and provides psychotherapy pro bono for homeless people. And she found out that there was a woman in England who was doing similar work. And she started a correspondence with this woman. And I know you think this has nothing to do with the question you asked, but it does.
No, I can see where you're going.
Okay. And this woman in England wrote back and said she was very interested in Deborah's work, and they corresponded a couple times. And I think at the end of the second correspondence, the woman said, and by the way, I'm paraphrasing, and by the way, you'll be interested to know that I am the Piggle.
Wow. And this was a big mystery. And we should bring our audience in on the fact, what is this Piggle thing about? What's the name Piggle refer to?
Well, I've tried to find out myself. The Piggle was the parents' nickname for this child. And they were English. And it's been brought to my attention that Piggle is a form of endearment for a little child in England. But then there's another origin to the story, too. Evidently, this little girl helped her father make a cake when she was two. And he wrote her a little thank you note saying, thank you for a delicious cake. And he drew a picture of himself as a half pig, half dog eating the whole cake. And she loved this picture so much. Oh. And afterwards, you know, two-year-olds are just starting to use language. She referred to herself as the pigga. So it may be that actually the parents started to call her the piggle after she started to call herself the pigga.
Yeah. So, of course, what came to my mind was the little toe game that you play with little ones. This little piggy went to the market. This little piggy went home. This little piggy cried, wee, 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 all the way home.
Yes.
I have four kids, so I got a lot of practice doing that. But they're grown adults now. And we should, you know, let people know, I'm going to ask you a little bit about Donald Winnicott, the therapist or analyst in this case, and a very well-known, very famous analyst. And one needs to remember that Freud had cases that were named, given like a name like the rat.
Dora, the rat man.
The rat man, yeah, that kind of. So this is the piggle. Yes. A la Freud saying the rat man. Okay.
No, I hadn't thought of that. Thank you for that.
Okay. Right. Yeah, it kind of helps to contextualize it a bit, I think. So I know you went to some lengths to say to me when you reached out to me that I'm no expert on Donald Winnicott. Nonetheless, give us a little overview, because there'll be people in the audience maybe who know nothing about Donald Winnicott. So give us your thumbnail sketch, if you will.
Well, Donald Winnicott was a very, very interesting man. He was a pediatrician, first and foremost. And for 40 years, he was a pediatrician in England. And he worked in clinics throughout London, including in the poorer sections. And I think he saw thousands and thousands of children over the course of his career as a pediatrician. But, you know, he worked in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. And during those years, you know, Freud was very much on everyone's mind. He was a part of, even of popular culture. People were very interested in the theories of Freud.
Yes.
And, of course, Donald Winnicott himself was very interested in Freud and in psychology. And as a young man, he sought out an analysis. And he was psychoanalyzed actually twice. And in one case, his analyst had actually been analyzed by Freud. So, of course, Winnicott was very, very influenced by the theories of Freud. And he became interested not just in his patients' physical health, but in their mental health and in their inner lives and in what caused physical ailments sometimes, you know, the psychosomatic connection. So he became interested and went into psychoanalytic training as a pediatrician. And in those days, that's what people did. Often they were medical doctors first and then became analysts through further training. So he went into analytic training and eventually became a child analyst. And in fact, he was the first male child analyst ever. Uh-huh. You know, you'll be familiar with Anna Freud was a child, probably the first child analyst, and Dorothy Burlingham and people like that. But they were all women. And Donald Winnicott loved children. He was very good with children. He was known to be gifted, you know, at understanding children. And so he became the first child psychoanalyst.
Wow. Now, a couple of times now, I'm not hearing it now, but a couple of times I heard an echo of my voice. Do you have ear pods or something, or maybe you could just turn down the volume a bit on your end. That might be it. Maybe you've got me too loud. Let's see how we do, because I'm not hearing it now. Boy, my nose is itching like crazy. I don't know why. So to pick up the thread here, so he ends up seeing, well, give us the presenting case. He was, the Piggle's parents reached out to him, right?
Yes, yes.
Because they were concerned about what?
Well, the Piggle's parents, were very concerned about their little girl. They had a two and a half year old almost girl, and she had suddenly become very sad, listless, sometimes lying in her crib, just sucking her thumb. And she also had terrible worries terrible fears at night. She was really haunted by these somewhere between dreams and visions of a black mother coming to her and a black father coming to her and scaring her in the night. She also scratched her face with her own fingernails. So she had a whole host of symptoms, self-harming symptoms, fears, worries, and also this listlessness, which if you have four children, you know that two-year-olds don't lie around sucking their thumbs unless they're tired. They just don't do that. Otherwise, they're running, they're playing, they're jumping, they're making mischief. They're having tantrums. They're doing everything, but they're usually not lying there just sucking their thumbs.
Yeah. Now, but she also, there's another element here in the story, right, that sibling rivalry, that a baby is born into the family?
Well, that is an interesting element, because the mother was very worried that the reason her daughter was having these symptoms was because they had had a second child. And the mother felt that they had the child too close in age to the piggle. The mother was became pregnant when the piggle was only 11 months old. And the mother felt very guilty about this. Now, whether that is really the origin of the piggle's symptoms or not is something that I take up in my chapter in the book. But that was the assumption by the parents, that this was the problem. And interestingly, Winnicott, I think in some what we now call confirmation bias, just assumed that himself. And that's something that hasn't been questioned in the history of this case. It really, except I think once, and I'll get to that. But it really had that formulation of why the piggle, whose name was actually Gabrielle, why Gabrielle was so upset, that hasn't really been questioned. It was sort of taken you know, as truth, that it was because she had this sister born. And the interesting thing is that in the book, The Piggle, Winnicott doesn't say, and the parents never say, when her symptoms started. And that's something I'm interested in. Did they start after they brought the baby home? Did they start while the mother was in the hospital? Did they start before the baby was born? That's never mentioned.
Important questions. And just to clear up any possible confusion here, you mentioned the piggle. It turns out that Donald Winnicott wrote a book, right, or a major paper called The Piggle.
Well, that's what I was referring to at the beginning. The book called The Piggle is the book I read in graduate school.
Yeah. And you've written a book called The Piggle, and it's a collection of papers.
No, my book is called Finding the Piggle.
Oh, Finding, yes, right. I've got it right in front of me, the title. Finding the Piggle, and it's a collection of essays written by a number of analysts, including yourself.
Yes.
So I just want people to have that background.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Classic book is called The Piggle. That's the classic that's been out in print, and it's never gone out of print since 1977. I mean, it's been in print for decades and decades, and it's been just a classic since it was published.
That's one of the things that amazed me getting into your book, was discovering that here's this hotbed of psychoanalytic thought and dispute that I never even knew about or heard about, even though in graduate school, I was in a pretty psychoanalytic program, but without any child emphasis. So I had never come across that in 700 interviews and, all my background.
Well, I'll get on my soapbox and tell you, I think this is the problem with a lot of training in psychology and psychiatry, is there is not enough understanding of child development and the inner workings of the child's mind. I think that is a huge problem, because all adults were once children. And in order to understand the adult, you've got to understand child development.
Well, I think one of the good things, and it's good to hear you saying that, and of course you've got a background in psychology as well, so you know that there's been a lot of learning and science around child development since the time of Freud. So our knowledge of the stages of development, I don't know how well they map to Freud's ideas, but we know a lot in a much greater detail than he would have known and than the early analysts would have known. Would you agree with that?
I do agree with that, but I also think there's an issue here. What we now call childism, I think, has been in effect for a long, long time, which is there was not interest in children. Children were actually sort of, in a way, ignored, discriminated against. They were a large part of the population who had no voice because they were children, and they weren't studied as much, you know. And child analysts, even to this day, are considered sort of a lesser form of analyst. And for years and years, you could not become a child analyst unless you first became an adult analyst. But adult analysts do not have to be child analysts.
Yes. So when you did you become an adult analyst first and then sort of get extra training on top of that to become a child analyst?
That's what you have to do. These days, there are a few places where you can do child analytic training alone, but very few. So yes, I had to become an adult analyst first, which is many, many years of training. And then at a certain point, I was allowed to take the child classes. So I did some of that training simultaneously with my adult training.
Uh-huh. Fascinating. And now, one of the things that I learned reading through the book, and I particularly read in detail Professor Brett Carr, who my most attentive fans out there will know that I've interviewed a number of times, a British analyst and a very public figure in analysis, and a historian, really, in many ways. I think that's his main gig, really. Took me a while to figure that out, but he's very much a psychoanalytic historian. And something that I learned in his contribution in this book was that Winnicott at this point was in his 70s and was extremely busy. He was a kind of guy who kept himself compulsively busy all the time. So he had speaking engagements and, you know, presentations to do and travels to do and other cases that he was working on and so on. So somewhere that's got to be factored into what did or did not happen. But tell us, how would you describe his approach? What did Winnicott do with this child who was 2.5, and how long did it go on?
Well, the brilliance of Winnicott is that he got right down on the floor. And that was typical of Winnicott. Even as an old man, he got right down on the floor and he played. And that's how he entered the inner world of the child. And that is the way to enter the inner world of the child. Anyone who has ever dealt with children knows this. If you see a little 3-year-old and you say, "How was your day today?" which is what the grandparents often say, or "What did you do today?" The child just looks at you blankly because they're not thinking about what they did this morning or what they had for lunch. They're thinking about right now. They're thinking about what they're thinking about right in this moment. So Winnicott got on the floor and he got down and he played with Gabrielle. And that was the way he went about understanding what was on her mind. He watched what she played with. He made comments about what she was playing. He entered into her imaginative world with her and played with her. And that was his technique. But I have to say that's not to say that he wasn't influenced by his own theoretical background, and he was. And as I have read the case and reread the case, I think he may have been a little bit overly influenced by some of his preconceived theoretical ideas. And I think there's
such as what would be an example of of his particular approach.
So if you read The Piggle today, you know, if somebody hears this interview and goes out and buys the book and reads The Piggle, what you'll see is that he sits down on the floor, and in the first session, you know, he says to the Piggle, she's picking up toys and saying, here's another toy, another toy, another toy. She's looking at all of his toys. And he brings up the birth of her sister. He says, oh, you're talking about the birth of your sister. Well, to me, that was a bit of a leap. You know, he thought she was talking about another baby, another baby, another baby. Maybe, maybe not. And then she goes to playing with a car, and she's trying to put a man in the car, and she can't quite fit him in. So then Winnicott makes a very deep, what we would call a very deep interpretation about a man sticking something into a lady. So he's making interpretations about that have sexual content. He's making interpretations about Gabrielle's jealousy of her sister getting more attention from the father, her mother getting more attention from the father than she gets. Is that in the play? That's sort of the test. Is it really in the play? We have to look at the play and think, was that really there? Or was that Winnicott kind of putting his theory onto what was being played? And of course, it's never fair to second guess somebody who did something, you know, 60 years ago. We weren't there. We weren't in the room. You know, it's hard to say. He was a very intuitive man. He was a brilliant, brilliant therapist. So it's a bit arrogant for me to even suggest maybe that wasn't. But if you read the book, there's a chapter also by a wonderful Winnicott scholar, Christopher Reeves, and who's now deceased. But he says some similar things in his chapter. And everyone agrees this was a brilliant treatment and Winnicott was brilliant. But there may have been moments where his own theoretical biases entered in and where his own personal history had an effect on how he understood what was being played out by the little girl.
Now, did he invent play therapy, or did play therapy already exist?
You know, I am not an expert on the history of psychoanalysis and child analysis. I don't think he invented play therapy. I think Anna Freud and Dorothy Burlingham and all those people were playing with children in the office when they saw children. I think that was, and Melanie Klein for sure, who was a very famous child psychoanalyst and who was Winnicott's supervisor. So no, I guess you couldn't say that he invented child therapy, but he was known as having been a brilliant practitioner of using play therapy to enter into the child's imaginative world.
Okay. And some other interesting things I learned from Professor Carr's historical treatment was that Winnicott was known to the parents. It's not like they came in from the street and said, hey, our child has a problem. He was well known. I forget the exact details. I don't think they were exactly friends already, but they were traveling in the same circles.
Well, this is interesting. When I read The Piggle, I didn't know any of this because the background isn't in the original book. The original book is really just the case. That's what it is. And that's sort of its brilliance. It's just a case. That's what it is. You see the child's play and you see the analyst's interventions and that's all. But now that I've worked on the book and I've read quite a bit about the case, about, you know, the history, Winnicott's history, history of his contemporaries, et cetera, what I learned was that the Piggle's mother herself was evaluated by Anna Freud. She came from Czechoslovakia, the mother, and she was part of a very upper middle class family, a very educated family. And when she started to be mischievous as a little girl, her parents sent her to see Anna Freud. And interestingly, Anna Freud said there was nothing wrong with her. She was just a mischievous little girl. But at any rate, the Piggle's mother was brought up with the idea that there are doctors who can help children, and when children have problems, that they can be helped by psychoanalysts. And she was evidently part of a world where psychoanalysis was accepted and used. And then she herself went on to get a degree in economics at the London School of Economics, but she became a therapist. So the mother, this is not revealed in the original Pigle book, but it turns out the mother was a therapist herself. And when you read the book, the original book, you see how sensitive this mother is to her child and how worried she is about her child. And you do wonder, why is this mother so worried? Lots of people have second children, you know, within a year and a half, 2 years. Why is this particular mother so worried? But it turns out, you know, she was a therapist and she was also carrying her own guilt. She had, and her own feelings, she had had a brother born 2 years after she was born, and she resented that brother, and she hated that brother when they were little. So she felt she was doing the same thing to her daughter that had been done to her, and that was the origin of her guilt.
And she might have probably discussed that over dinner with Dr. Winnicott. I mean, they actually socialized together. I don't know how much before the case, but it seems like during the case, he was consulting with the parents regularly.
Yes, he did. And she told Winnicott that she felt that they, she said in her words, it was, we hadn't been clever enough to arrange not to have a baby so soon. Now, whether she told Winnicott that she was resentful of her own brother, that I'm not sure of. And they did socialize, although I'm not sure that was before Winnicott saw the Pigle. I think that may have been after.
Okay, they did become friends and maintain a relationship long after the treatment was over.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. So there are all these other little threads there that makes one wonder a bit.
Yeah, and it's interesting because these days we wouldn't do that. We wouldn't have dinner with our patients' families. We wouldn't go to visit them at their home.
Right. This is so far away from, quotes, the blank screen that people spoke about in the early days.
Yes. Well, we still believe in that to some degree. I mean, those of us that were more classically trained, we still try to not tell too much about ourselves to our patients. But when you're a child analyst, it's different. You don't present a blank screen. You have to be a human being. You really do.
Yeah. Okay. Good point. Good point. So the treatment went on. Talk to us about how long this treatment was.
Well, altogether it was 5 years, but Winnicott only saw Gabrielle 16 times. So he called this treatment on demand. This is the way he was seeing patients at this time. He had at one point seen children in analysis, you know, every day, 5 days a week. But at this point, he was older. As you said, he was busy. So he saw children in brief consultations usually. And there's a book called Consultations in Child Psychiatry, which I recommend to everybody. You can buy it used on Amazon. It's for $2. And it's so brilliant. Winnicott could see a child once or twice and get right to the heart of that child's difficulties.
Is this by Winnicott, the book that you're recommending?
Is. Yes. Uh-huh. Yes, it's his consultations with children that took place over 1, 2, 3 sessions. It's just a brilliant book. And evidently, when he first saw Gabrielle the Pigle, he thought he would just see her once. But it didn't turn out that way. He ended up seeing her again and again and again. And it was pretty much on demand when either the Pigle asked to see him or when the parents asked for her to be seen. But sometimes there were gaps of, once there was a gap of 6 months. So, you know, it wasn't very frequent. And in between, the parents would write to Winnicott and he would write back.
Okay. And I got the impression that Winnicott got some criticism from some quarters of other psychoanalysts who were critical of this idea of on-demand therapy.
Yes, he was really an iconoclast. He did things his own way. He was a very creative man, and this applied also to his theory building and his emphasis. I mean, he was very interested in children and mothers, and he famously said there's no such thing as a baby, by which he meant you can't have a baby in isolation. You have to, if you're looking at a baby, you have to look at the baby and the mother and what kind of environment the mother provides for the baby and what they're
So that's already a forerunner of a systems approach.
Exactly.
Family systems, family therapy.
Yes, and also the,
and all,
all the
and also short-term therapy.
Yeah, but also he was really a forerunner of all the infant research that's been done, Beatrice Beebe and Tronick and all these people who've looked at mother-infant interactions and how important mm-hmm. they are and how much they tell us about child development. So actually now I forget what your original question was.
I don't remember it either.
I went on a tangent.
But we're talking. That's the good thing okay. here. I think we're covering all the important ground. I guess I had asked you how long treatment was, and you had spoken to that.
Yes, yes. Oh, and about his being iconoclastic. That's right. So, yes. So yeah. people were seeing children in analysis 4 and 5 days a week. And people in analysis were usually in analysis on the couch 4 and 5 days a week, probably mostly 5. And so the fact that he was playing, a lot of adult analysts didn't like that he was seeing a 2.5-year-old girl, that was unheard of. I mean, even these days, mm-hmm. there are very few analysts ready to see a 2.5-year-old. I've seen a 2.5-year-old. It was delightful. But a lot of people don't feel ready to see such a young child. But at any rate, he did see very young children, and he did break a lot of rules. He made up his own rules. He did what he thought the case needed. He didn't feel he had to adhere to some, you know, idea of frequency defining what analysis is.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's praiseworthy, I think. And I think at first she was she didn't like fall in love with him right away. She was a little suspicious of him, and but as you mentioned, there comes a point where she's actually asking to see him.
Oh yes,
he's seen as a nice man and somebody who's, you know, who's fun and.
Oh no, it was much more than that. Oh no, she knew right away that he was a doctor and he was there to help her, and her shyness only lasted 10 minutes. I mean, after that, it was gone. And he was very clever. He let the mother come in to the room with her, which is what we all would do now. You have the parent come in if the child is scared to come in by themselves. He had the mother sit on the couch. And then there was a teddy bear. And he said to her, she said, "I'm too shy." And she stood away from him. But then he said, "Bring Teddy over here. I want to show Teddy my toys," which is something we would all do now. You don't ask the child to come over if they're scared, but you ask them to bring a toy over and say, "I want to show your toy, all my toys." And then they gladly bring the toy over, and then they gradually get more comfortable. And that's exactly what Winnicott did. He showed the teddy bear all his toys. And within minutes, she was sitting on the floor right next to Winnicott, looking at all his toys, talking about, and they were talking together. And she was very clear that he was a doctor and he was there for helping her. And she got down to work immediately, trying to tell him and ask him to help her with her worries.
Wow. You make it sound like fun. I mean, it sounds like fun getting down on the floor with little kids.
It's fun and it's hard work, actually, because you're trying constantly to think on both the surface level. You're trying to play with the child, but you're also trying to think, what is this about? How does this link to this child's worries? How does this link to this child's symptoms? How does this link to this child's history? So you're having to think on multiple levels at the same time.
And are you also trying to intervene on a symbolic level of making a solution between the toys somehow?
Well, you're trying – the first thing is to help the child understand their own worry. And that's one thing you see in this case in the Piggle is that – Winnicott didn't immediately understand. He immediately started to make interpretations, which we don't do so much anymore. But Melanie Klein, who was his supervisor, is known for that. And she has a book, she had a book published called Analysis of a 5-Year-Old Boy, or Narrative of an Analysis, I think it's called, and it's about a 5-Year-Old Boy. Well, she made very direct interpretations from the first moment. And Winnicott followed that technique. But if you read the Piggle, you see that as time goes on, she starts to ask Winnicott, "Do you know about," and she had a thing she was afraid of called the Babacar. "Do you know why the Babacar?" And he couldn't answer that. And she lost faith in him at a certain point. And she went home and she said, "Dr. Winnicott can't help me." Up until that point, she was sure that he was going to help her. But then you see that within a very short time, she comes back and she feels again that he is helping her. So yes, you try always to understand, but you don't always understand, not right away. And at certain moments, it takes time to understand.
Yeah. Now, there's another angle that subsequently came out among, I guess, some of the other people who are in your book, that there was the possibility of intergenerational trauma or transgenerational trauma, that this was a Jewish family, that they had I guess they had their own close brushes or they lost people in their family. Can you fill that out for us a bit?
Sure, sure. Well, actually, they weren't a Jewish family. The mother was Czechoslovakian. She had come from Czechoslovakia. And she was, let's see, when she was 11, she was sent to boarding school in England and she went to a girls' school. Her family was Jewish. And she went back and forth across Europe from boarding school to home, boarding school to home. And then when she was 18, the war broke out. And she got out of Czechoslovakia on a faked passport with her youngest brother and went to London for one last time and left a great number of her family in Czechoslovakia. And that was the part of the family that perished. Not all of them, but some of them perished in the Holocaust. This was also never mentioned in the original book, The Piggle.
Right.
It was mentioned, I think, maybe that the mother had an accent, but you didn't know any of her history. So it turns out, and this comes out in Deborah Lubnitz's interviews with the adult Gabrielle, that the mother lost family in the Holocaust. The father was Irish, and he actually grew up partially in South Africa. And at a certain point when there was a revolution in South Africa, he had to leave South Africa and go back to Ireland with his family. So both the mother and the father had traumatic histories. They both lost their countries. But the father's family was Irish, I assume, probably Catholic. I don't know, really. But they both had traumatic histories of one kind or another. So very interestingly, what Deborah Lubnitz finds out is that Gabrielle was named actually Esther Gabrielle. She was named for a member of the family who had perished in the Holocaust. But she was not called Esther. And Deborah talks a lot in her chapter and in her paper, it was originally a paper, about the meaning of having a name that can't be spoken. And what Gabrielle and Deborah talked about was the possibility that maybe the name Esther wasn't used because it was too painful to call this little child Gabrielle, who was born in England, by the name of the relative who had perished in the Holocaust. So she was called by her middle name. So yes, so then there's been some speculation how much of this little girl's sadness and fears, how much of that might have come from the traumatic history of the parents and the grandparents. And we know that children, grandchildren of Holocaust survivors can suffer, even though they themselves were not in the Holocaust and their parents were not in the Holocaust. The trauma can be passed down in very subtle ways that we're not even aware of. And it's called the intergenerational transmission of trauma. So it's a very interesting, interesting mechanism.
Yeah, yeah, I'll say. So she did get better. Piggle Gabrielle actually got better and became a high-functioning, normal person, right?
Absolutely, yes. She by the age of five, Winnicott thought she was just a healthy, normal little girl. But he was convinced that without the treatment, she wouldn't have. And the parents were convinced of that, too. That's one thing that we all struggle with when we work with children. You never know how much is maturation, how much is development, and how much is your intervention. We never know, you know, how much of a part we play in a child getting better. Right. We don't know how they would have done without us. But it's interesting in this case, both the parents and Winnicott were convinced that without the treatment, she wouldn't have done as well.
Well, Professor Carr learned, you know, that the pickle was now an adult and was known, and he reached out to her and asked her to join him for dinner, and took her to a restaurant and asked her about, well, what did she recall of the treatment and so on. And do you remember anything about that? Can you flesh that out a little bit more about what her view of it all as an adult looking back?
Yes. Well, I should say she has been very generous with her time and with her willingness to talk about her own treatment. Because, you know, usually we don't know. When case histories are written up, they're usually disguised more than this one was. And usually the name is disguised, which this one wasn't, which has been a matter of some speculation and conjecture why that was. And even by Gabrielle herself. And she's been very generous, though, in talking about this. And I think there were some people who always knew who she was. I think some of the historians knew who she was. I suspect Professor Carr always knew who she was. I didn't know, and most psychologists, psychiatrists, psychoanalysts didn't know who she was. But I think she was known to, of course, to a few people. So, yes, he took her out to dinner. It turns out, sadly, for those of us who wish she did remember more, that she doesn't remember her treatment. You know, she was a very little child.
Yeah.
She said she remembers a little bit of Winnicott. She has a couple memories. I think she said that she remembered the radiator and she remembered something about shoes in his office, but she remembers very little. And what she does remember, she thinks probably comes from the families having entertained him in later years, you know, when she was a child. She thinks most of her memory of him comes from that time in her life. So she only remembers a very, very little about him, his office, and the play they did together.
Yeah. So why do you think that this case has been so has had so much celebrity, if you will, that has been a football that's being kicked around a lot by psychoanalysts?
Well, I think there's nothing like getting inside the mind of another person. I think that's why we all went into the field. You know, we're curious about the minds of others. We want to understand the inner world of others. And to get inside the mind of a 2.5-year-old, even if some of it is speculative, to try to get on the level of a 2.5-year-old and her fantasies and her fears, I mean, that's unparalleled. I don't know of another case history like this one. And So it's really remarkable for having been written when it was. It's remarkable for being written by Donald Winnicott, who was just a brilliant analyst. And we, you know, there are many people who just love so much of what he wrote about mothers and babies and about human development. And this was an example of his work. So to get to see someone of his stature in terms of how they worked moment to moment is also quite a privilege. You know, in the introduction of to the Pickle written by Winnicott's wife after his death, she says essentially he invites the world into his consulting room. By writing this and allowing it to be published, he invited the world into his office. Mm-hmm. And how often do we get to be in the office, you know, of a therapist, let alone a child therapist, to see what they really do and how they think and how the child thinks. It's just
amazing. Yeah, that's so important because what subsequent research on therapy and therapists has shown is that often there's a bit of what therapists say they do, and they will give you the whole theoretical structure, you know, that they have in their mind about it all. But that if you actually see them in action, what they're doing will be more like other therapists from other schools than they might care to admit.
That's
there's
right.
A sort of common ground of what a human being is going to do with another human being.
Well, evidently,
to be effective.
Evidently, there's certain curative factors in therapy that cross all boundaries of theory. And there have been famous studies done on what the curative factors are in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. And you're right. In most therapies, the curative factors have to do with instilling hope in the person and establishing a relationship with the person that's different from some of the other probably hurtful relationships they've had in their lives. Although I must say, in this era of cognitive therapy, I quite honestly, that doesn't necessarily share all the same elements that some of the other therapies do. The emphasis is not on the relationship usually in cognitive therapy, right, which I could say a lot about, but I'll restrain myself.
I was for a long time of that persuasion, but I've gotten the impression that some of the less mechanistic aspects of therapeutic treatment have crept into the way that cognitive behavior therapists work now.
Well, I hope that's true.
I think it could be.
Because, for example, in the Piggle, the relationship between this little girl and this doctor, you have to think that was one of the curative factors. Can you imagine being a 2.5-year-old who had a famous doctor be interested in her? And she knew he was famous because he was talked about in her home. He was revered by her parents. She knew this was an important man, and he was interested in her. And he played with her. And he didn't spend time with her mother or her father or her sister. He spent time with her. And so that had to have quite an impact. That relationship had to have been very important to her.
Yeah, I like the way you put that. Really brings it home to me. And now I feel deprived that I don't have that in my background. I think you've kind of already spoken to this, but I'm wondering of what use or value, what can people who are therapists now, either analysts or psychologists, therapists of different stripes, take away from your book, from this case?
Oh, I think there's so much to take away from it. I'm not sure I can summarize. The first thing, though, is that little children have inner lives. Children of 2 years old have inner lives. Don't be afraid to imagine, if you have only adult patients, what their inner lives must have been like as 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds. Don't be afraid to go back there and think about that and imagine that, because they have inner lives, they have beliefs, they have worries all their own. So that would be the first thing. I guess the second thing is the fact that we can work with young children. Don't be afraid to work with children as young as 2.5 and 3. Early intervention is so important. If a child is depressed at 2 or 3, if you can get to them, or if they're anxious at 2 or 3, if you can get to them then, if you can help their parents to understand them, if you can help them to understand themselves, it's so much better than waiting until they're adolescents and they're having real big problems. Mm-hmm. So early intervention is important. There's so many things to be gained from this. The analytic method, while you may not agree with all the theories, and some of it, if you read The Piggle right now, might sound a little crazy to you, some of the theories are still tried and true. And you may think they sound crazy, but you know what? A lot of them really make a lot of sense once the patient is at a point in their treatment where they're really feeling some of the feelings they had when they were 2 and 3 and 4. For example, the Oedipal conflict. People think that's baloney, that little girls don't fall in love with their daddies and little boys don't fall in love with their mommies. But you know what? If you've ever had a child and you have watched how they develop, little girls fall in love with their daddies, and mothers can feel quite pushed out of the picture for a little while there. And little boys do fall in love with their mommies. Usually, some little boys, it's the reverse. They fall in love with their daddy and they, want to get rid of the mommy. So it's not always exactly the same way. But some of these theories you really see borne out.
I've got a personal example of what you're saying here, that one of my sons was young enough to still be in the crib, and I had been traveling for business. I had a kind of parallel career in marketing research. And so I periodically traveled to different cities, and And my little son looks at me in the crib and he says, "Daddy, I wish you would go on a trip, go on a long trip." <You know? laughs> The message, I don't remember if he said it explicitly, but the underlying message was, "Mommy and I are having so much fun and getting along so well without you."
That's right. No competition from you if you're away.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was a real eye-opener for me, you know, like, wow, this really is, there's something to this edible stuff.
That's here. Right. That's right. Yeah. It's interesting if we can be open to some of these theories being partially true, somewhat true, sometimes true, they can inform us about child development. We can just, you know, take some of it in and understand a little bit more about what the child might be feeling at that moment.
Yeah, I like your attitude about that. So tell us, as we wind down here, I'd like to learn a little bit more about you and your work. You've written a previous book. Was that also a collection of papers?
That was a collection of essays, just as this one is. And it was called Flirting with Death.
And, well, tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. Well, that's a subject nobody wants to talk about.
Right.
And that's actually...
I'm willing for a minute or two to listen before I jam my fingers in my ears.
You saved it till we didn't have any time, right? That's what everyone does. So that's what the book is about. It's about how in treatment, often therapists and analysts have a hard time confronting death with their patients. And anyone listening to this who's a therapist will say, "Oh, I don't do that. No, I don't do that. I meet it head on. I'm right there with it." But quite honestly, you know, if people are willing to look at themselves and their process, what we often find out is that it raises anxiety in us. If a patient wants to start talking about death, their fear of death, their feelings about death, if they, the minute suicide is mentioned, we get very, very, very anxious. And in my own analysis, I can tell you that when I brought up my fear of death, which was lifelong, I was so afraid of death from the time I was 6 years old. And my mother, I asked my mother what happens after death, and she said, "Nothing." That's literally what she said, "Nothing." I was afraid of death from that moment on. And I know in my own analysis, my analyst did not take up the subject. I would talk about my fear of death, how afraid I was, what my mother said, what that made me think about, how I became an existentialist at the age of 6. And my analyst never talked about it with me. He would listen, but he just never said anything. Yeah, and, you know, in the olden days with Freud would always interpret death and anxiety as some other kind of anxiety. He would say, "Well, what you're really afraid of is castration, or what you're really afraid of is something else." But actually, in my opinion, lots of people are afraid of death. They don't understand what it is, what happens afterwards. They don't want to stop living. There's a lot of anxiety. And someone named Sheldon Solomon wrote a book called Terror Management. And he's a sociologist at Skidmore. And this book is a very interesting book. And it utilizes a lot of the work of Ernest Becker, who wrote a book called The Denial of Death.
I read that one.
Yes, that was famous. It was a bestseller. Yeah. And then everyone loved it and then stopped talking about it.
Yeah.
So I'm writing in the legacy of Ernest Becker, I'm writing about, and I'm having other people write about their personal experiences with death, their personal experiences with patients who brought up the theme of death, their avoidance of it, or their confrontation with it, or their fears about it. So in that book, there's chapters on the death of a patient, the death of an analyst, the avoidance of death in therapy, all sorts of things.
Yeah, wow. Well, it's very timely, I must say, because right now death is really in our face.
Well, that's
with the pandemic.
That's the thing. And I have a third book that's in press right now called When a Child Grieves. And what I said in the introduction to that book is maybe I should have waited a little while because, you know, so many children and so many adult children are losing parents and grandparents. And it's, you know, with this epidemic, it's just pandemic. It's just a horrible time. We're all in grief of one sort or another. We're grieving the privileges we've lost to be free and to socialize. We're grieving, you know, actual people who've died. We're grieving the illusion of our own health, because we all know we can get ill at any moment. So there are a lot of things we're grieving. So in the introduction, I say that. But anyway, the book is going to be published, and it's about how children grieve.
Okay. Yeah. And also you have a parenting blog. What would you like us to know about that?
Well, I hope if there are any parents listening, they'll go and look at the blog. We try to not be like every other blog on the internet that just has some collection of crazy information and opinion that's based on not so much. This blog, we try to have opinion pieces based on child developmental theory, sort of solid parenting advice. There are lots of columns about how to deal with COVID anxiety, being quarantined at home, both for how to deal with parents' own feelings and how parents can deal with the children's feelings. And I'll just give you the address if you don't mind. It's www.thoughtfulparenting.org. So it's, and there's another blog with a similar title, and it probably won't hurt if you read that one, but this one is www.thoughtfulparenting.org. And there are also some fun things on it, you know, crafts, projects, and recipes, but most of it is sound advice using child development principles. And, you know, some basically psychodynamic principles for understanding how children feel and how parents feel.
Sounds like it's not written just by you, but by their contributors.
It's mostly by me. And then I have a young mother who contributes some of the crafts projects and things like that. And then I have guest bloggers sometimes who are young mothers who are also therapists usually.
Yeah.
Talking about their own experiences.
Okay, well, as we wind down here, is there anything else that you'd like to say that maybe we haven't touched on?
I just appreciate the opportunity to talk about the Piggle and to talk about child therapy. It's not done enough. We don't talk enough about children and their needs and their worries and their anxieties and their feelings. So I really, really appreciate the opportunity to do so with you.
Oh, good. Yeah, me too. I was so happy to have learned about that. So, Dr. Corinne Mazur, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much.
I found Dr. Corinne Mazur to be a charming and delightful guest. It was really quite an adventure to discover the world of the Piggle. Completely unknown to me before this, despite a long history of poking around in a variety of psychoanalytic corners. It was fascinating to learn that Donald Winnicott wrote a book himself about the case, The Piggle. Dr. Mazur's book, Finding the Piggle, along with our discussion, expanded my knowledge of Winnicott's work and importance. I found the chapter in Mazur's book by Professor Brett Carr painted a very full picture of both Winnicott and the adult Piggle, which should not be surprising because Professor Carr is a renowned Winnicott scholar. Longtime listeners will recall my own interview with him on Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 567, Tea with Winnicott, which was about his book with the same name. If you haven't heard that one, it would be a good companion piece to today's interview. It must be said that Dr. Mazur is a very distinguished psychoanalyst in her own right. She's a child and adult psychoanalyst who's been in practice for over 35 years, treating children, adolescents, and adults. She's also the co-founder of the Parent-Child Center of Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Center for Psychoanalytic Education, and the Philadelphia Declaration of Play. She's on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia and the Institute for Relational Psychotherapy and Psychoanalysis. Despite this impressive set of credentials, I found her to be very warm and approachable, contrary to the stereotype that I think many hold of psychoanalysts. As she spoke about her work on the floor with children, I found myself a bit envious of children who get her special attention, as I also did when she described the way both the young and adult Piggle felt so prized by the distinguished Dr. Winnicott. But enough about my own regressive longings. I was particularly impressed by Dr. Mazur's suggestion that we hold lightly some of the farther-out Freudian concepts such as Oedipal dynamics. As she said, sometimes they're there with little girls and their fathers, and sometimes with little boys and their mothers, but not always. We need to be careful not to force these Freudian dynamics when they're not there, but neither should we be blind to them when they do crop up. I also loved her closing remarks that we should value the inner world of children as well as the recollections of those times in our adult patients. Young children of 2 or 3 already have very vivid and active mental lives, and there's much we can learn from them. Similarly, I believe Dr. Mazur when she suggests that therapists of today can learn much from the historic case of the Piggle. Dr. Mazur's book, once again, is Finding the Piggle, D.W. Winnicott's most famous child case. And once again, her blog can be found at thoughtfulparenting.org.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Andrea Nuss, and I made a donation because I support Shrink Wrap Radio. I feel I stay on the cutting edge of all things therapy, and I gained a lot of insight on my own way of being. It's been an incredible resource to me in my still young career. Thank you, Dr. Dave, and your guests for providing such an engaging platform of information.
Thank you, Andrea Nuss. I'm glad you find Shrink Wrap Radio to be such a valuable resource. And thanks for your financial support and encouragement for others to follow your example. With that, we'll wrap it up once again. Thanks so much to psychoanalyst Dr. Corinne Mazur for discussing her book, Finding the Piggle, Reconsidering D.W. Winnicott's Most Famous Child Case. My return guest next week will be the very dynamic licensed professional counselor and author, Courtney Armstrong, speaking about ways of evoking positive emotional states in psychotherapy. I hope you'll join us then. So until then, please remember to be kind to yourself and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.